From the east side to the west, this is From the Land, the Cleveland Sports and More podcast. I'm your host, Jason Gerber, and friends, this week we made the difficult decision to end our show after almost 4 years and decided that this month will be our last. We are here tonight with only 3 episodes to go, and we are talking a disappointing Cavs week, injuries coming for the Guardians, and heading out on the road where there is a lot of football to talk as NFL free agency takes off. Off the field, we look back to 1993 with Running in the Cinema Classics and our review of Tombstone. I am joined tonight by two of the best ever. My co-hosts, Phil Danko and Chuck Rambaldo, are here. Fellas, can I interest you in green beer and gunfights tonight?
Yes, sir. I like both of those things all year round, really.
Yeah, I'm interested. I don't know about all year round. Most of my gunfighting is saved for hot August nights. So
more tombstone-y.
Yeah, it is a lot more tombstone-y. All right, well, we are going to get rolling and start at home where we always do. Our sip of wine and gold, our weekly Cavs recap. The week started fine, and then not. The still shorthanded Cavs played well and battled in a tough loss to the Suns early in the week. They welcomed Donovan Mitchell back for a dominant win on the road against a good Pelicans team, and then went to Houston and took a dump in an ugly loss to the Rockets. After the game, Mitchell announced that he may have come back too early and may miss some more time getting his knee healthy. Cavs finished the losing week at 42-25 in the 3 seed in the Eastern Conference. Scale of 1 to 5, 1 being 2016 Iluin Oregon Pinot Noir, described as disturbingly vicious in texture, maybe made from grapes, just say no. 5 being Crimson, a red wine from Chateau Huff on East 66th in Cleveland. How would you rate the week?
I like that you brought this scale back. I know we're winding down here. That's a nice callback. I'm going to say a 2 because the 1 was the shit scale. I'm going to say a 2. As undermanned as this team is at times, I liked some of Monday. I loved Wednesday. And there's sometimes no excuse for what happened Saturday, no matter who's playing or who isn't. So I'm going to sit at a 2. It's just this is now what, the third plus week of up and down basketball. And that makes me real nervous heading towards the playoffs that, you know, like, especially on a game like Sunday, where it's a sub 500 team, not a bad team though. It just tells me like they're really not ready for a playoff run if they're losing those kind of games.
I think I'm going to put it at a 1. I think it was that shitty of a week. Like, it was just say no week for me. It was 3 weeks in a row now, like you said, Chuck, of just this up and down Cavs play. And that's understandable given the injuries and the roster they're trotting out there. But the reason I give this particular week a 1 is we spoke last week about it could be 0-3. Let's hope for 2-1, probably 1-2, whatever. You split the first 2 games against playoff teams and you did it. You did it. And you just come back against Houston, who is, okay, they're a young, decent team, but man, your leading scorer was LeVert off the bench. Like, this is just bad. Garland and Mitchell combined didn't have a normal Mitchell or Garland stat line in that game. And then you find out afterwards that Mitchell's probably going to sit down for another week or two, who knows. And Allen went for like 10 points and 7 boards. Like, what the hell happened against the Rockets? You were sitting pretty to go 2-1 in a week that, again, against all odds, but you would come through it pretty good. And you kind of blew it on that last game. I don't know. I don't know what that was. The first 2 games, I really like what I saw to Garland. Like, that was great. I thought going into that game against Houston, I'm like, here we go. All right, Mitchell, take a seat if you need to. Let Darius take over. And none of that happened.
I'm as down this week as you guys. I'm probably at like a 3, like somewhere around the middle. And my fingers crossed that maybe they're just in a little bit of a slump and they can snap out of this and, you know, get healthy and get headed in the right direction with plenty of time still to go before the playoffs. I really thought they played great against Phoenix in that game on Monday night. They didn't have Mitchell and they battled. I think they ended up losing by 6, but that's one of those games where with a minute left, it's a 1 basket game, you know, and it was that one little just mistake. Okoro stepped out on the sideline and they lost that possession. He catches that ball and hits that shot in rhythm and they win that game. Man, that was a really tough game. They looked great against the Pelicans. And I guess maybe for better or for worse, I was pub crawling on Saturday and didn't even know the game had been played until I got home thinking I was going to watch it. And then, yeah, and it was an early game. So maybe it's best that I missed that. I really hope this is just a slump and that they can snap out of it and that the first two games of the week are more representative of where the team is than the last one. My biggest problem, though, is the Mitchell thing. If he's down for another 2 weeks, that is a huge problem for this team. I get it, man. I get that he wanted to get back and play. I totally understand that, but it would be a shame if this is like a big time setback for him. I hope that's not the case. What in the heck do we make of George Niang? At times he looks like he should be picked last at the Y, but since Mobley went out with an injury and he took that starting spot, he's averaging 14 points, 5 rebounds, and he's shooting 47% from three. What's the deal with George Niang?
I don't know. I think looking at this week in and week out, or at least the last 3 weeks with George in the starting rotation, he's really exceeding expectations for about two out of every three games. Because then he throws a clunker in there. It's like, oh, 0-for-9 from three and 8 points total. Like, oh, man. But the other two, he's on fire, man. He's like double-double guy. Like, so I don't know what to make of the, what's his nickname? The minivan? Maybe that's exactly right. He's a minivan. You know what? Going to be dependable most of the time.
I guess the way I look at it is he playing his way into a rotation for the playoffs? Because if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, it was no. Like, to me, he's a negative when he's on the floor. He doesn't play great defense. His numbers are always minus when he's out there. But at least he's filling somewhat of a void here now, and he's getting some meaningful minutes. And you're maybe I'm the fucking coach of the Cavs here. Oh, maybe I'm building some trust in him that he's going to be able to be part of a playoff rotation. I'm in the same boat as Phil. Like, I really don't know. Have I seen enough of him to think like he's a piece I could trust moving forward now? But does he surprise me every once in a while? I go, hey, that'd be nice. Sure. But I don't know that. How are we this far in the season? The guy they gave this big of a contract to, and we're still like, I don't know.
I think maybe the problem is that the highs are really high and the lows are really low. I mean, there are games where he comes in off the bench and he picks up three fouls in a minute and a half, and they got to go sit him back down because he's just so slow. And then there's games where he comes in and he's a tough player. He has some attitude. He hits some big shots. Then you get excited about him. It's really hard to tell. I still don't think he is going to be a regular in the playoffs, I guess, provided Mobley ever comes back. But if Mobley's back, I don't know if Niang's a regular in the playoffs just because his defense is so bad. Defense is going to be the key to their playoff run, I think. So we'll see. George Niang, we don't know you and we don't understand you. What's going on? All right. Happy times. Raise your wine and gold glasses. Who is your toast of the town for this week? Darius Garland, 30 points, 5 assists against the Suns. 27-11 against New Orleans. Jared Allen averaged a double-double for the week. Sam Merrill, 15 points and 9 assists in the Pelicans game, averaged 10 points, 5 assists for the week. How about this guy, first time on the list? Damian Jones, who, after getting more minutes because of the Mobley injury, he kind of settled in this week and averaged 9 points and 6 boards throughout this week's game. So, who gets your toast to the town?
I think if we can wash Saturday, I'll go back. I think I'm going back-to-back Garland weeks maybe.
Yeah,
but focusing in really on Wednesday, that was a fucking masterpiece. 27 points, 11 assists, 6 boards, and only turned the ball over once. And I have harped that he has turned the ball over a lot. 10 for 16 from the floor, 6 for 10 from deep, and there was no over-dribbling. There was no stagnation, just pure efficient dominance out of him is what we need when Donovan Mitchell is not playing. So I'm not saying every night needs to be that stat line, but I'd like to see a little bit more leaning in that direction than what he has been previously. And I know he's turning into a little bit of a different player too this year. Maybe that's why I've been beating him up, but 2 weeks in a row, he's trending in the right direction for me. And hopefully as the season rolls on, he becomes more consistent with those stat lines.
I had two guys on my list this week. One was Darius Garland for the first two games, and one was Sam Merrill for the last two games. So I'll take Sam Merrill. Because everything Chuck said about Darius is spot on. I can't improve upon that. Sam Merrill, these last two games, the 15 points on all five shots were three-pointers. That was phenomenal. That's what we need out of that guy, right? He had 9 assists. How does that guy have 9 assists coming off the bench?
Yeah, he's playing insane. Like 17 minutes a game.
Yeah, right. So that was huge in that New Orleans game. That's why we won that game, is everyone was contributing, and really that was impressive. And then the next game, comes out off the bench again, double digits, and has 8 rebounds. How does he have 8 rebounds in a game? I didn't know what was happening there. So I'm glad to see Sam Merrill kind of breaking out of this funk he's been in these last few weeks. Like, there were games where he was 0-for-9 from the field and just, oh my gosh, we're getting nothing out of this guy. So again, you know, assuming we can get the other key pieces healthy, I think a Sam Merrill is a good bench piece going into this playoff run.
I want to say Damian Jones, just because I was so surprised to see that guy be able to produce, but I can't go away from Garland. Just too good all week long, except for the game that I didn't watch, which is fantastic for me. But even in that Suns game, man, they're matching up bigger guards against him, and he handled it, and he was awesome in that game. And you saw kind of the same thing from New Orleans. They got some big dudes on that team too, and he was still able to produce, and it's always kind of the worry with him that when he starts matching up with those bigger guards, they're going to be able to push him around a little bit and shut him down. He had a fantastic week. I love the version of Darius Garland we saw 66.66% of the time this week. Hopefully my math is right. All right, next week. Cavs' upcoming week is full of winners and plane rides. Starting Monday in Indy against the Pacers. Wednesday back in the land against the Heat. Friday on the road in Minnesota, and Sunday in South Beach against the Heat again. No back-to-backs this week, but every opponent is a playoff team. How is this week going for the Cavs?
Ever hopeful, I'm going 2-2. We got to get 2 wins this week. Three of the games are playoff previews potentially, right? I mean, the Pacers and the Heat. Minnesota might get a little payback. 2-2. Give me 2-2 somehow this week.
Yeah, I think there's no better outcome for this team, the way they're playing, than 2-2. If we, a week from now, get back together and we're talking about 2-2 week, I'm going to be much happier, probably wearing the same Cavs hat. So if we go 2-2, I have nothing to bitch about.
2-2 would be fantastic. And I think if the team that showed up against the Suns and the team that showed up against the Pelicans shows up in all 4 of these games and some of that consistency comes back, I think they'd be in really good shape. I think they could definitely win 2 of these games if they're playing at that level for the entire week. Hopefully, that's what we're getting from the Cavs. Why don't we move on to our spring gardening, our look at the Cleveland Guardians spring training. This was supposed to be a super fun week, talking about the strength of the team, the starting rotation. But before we could even get to fun, second-year starter Gavin Williams was shut down with elbow soreness and is expected to be on the injured list to start the season. Tanner Bibee and Tristan McKenzie were both roughed up in their last starts, and we won't even be getting into the injuries that hit the bullpen this week. We have been talking about the Guardians in spring training for weeks. Is the health of the starting rotation the most important thing for a successful season, despite everything we've been talking about?
No question, man, because it allows us as fans to dream about the potential if the starting five are healthy. I'm trying to have earmuffs on, man, and not hear about what's going on, because there's such a slim margin for error when it comes to this team offensively. I think we all don't believe they're going to score a ton of runs, so they're going to rely on their starting pitching. And if pieces aren't going to be there, and returning pieces who are possibly one pitch away from Tommy John surgery, which terrifies me, I almost don't want to talk about the starting rotation tonight. So yeah, like I'm going to say, like, the potential is there for them to have the best pitching staff in the American League. It's there, even if the young guys are slightly better than they were last year, and they might be up and down, but still, like, this is what's going to carry this team through the season. And I'm not super excited about the start that they're having. So I'm a little nervous right now, but if this starting pitching goes, this team goes. That's how it's going to work out.
It is all about the starting rotation for this team. It has been for what seems like a decade, right? Like, I think that's how this team wins. So, you know, the Gavin Williams thing is a little bit more bothersome than the two guys getting roughed up, because that's an injury. Sure. We can't have that linger. So get him healthy. We need that guy in the rotation. If McKenzie and Bibee got roughed up in spring training but are otherwise healthy, I feel pretty good going into the season with a Bieber, McKenzie, Bibee top three, if Williams needs to kind of take it easy. We need 4 it'd be great to have five, but we need four really good starters all year round that's getting this team through the sixth inning into the seventh. Otherwise, we're in trouble because there's a good chance this team puts up 3 runs a game on average. That's going to be
problematic. You think so?
That's generous.
On average. I think that's 3 runs a game. Losing record in the AL if they average 3 runs a game.
It's so important. Everything is important, though. The bullpen's important. Being able to score at least 3 runs a game is really important. But if this starting rotation can't stay healthy, this team can't go anywhere. It just needs to be healthy and effective. Bieber has been strong all spring. I actually listened to the game tonight. He had a start tonight against the Reds and was awesome. Pretty good chance he's not going to be around all season, as we've already kind of talked about before. Not counting him, who is the standout starter in this rotation this year? Is it finally Tristan McKenzie's year? Is it Tanner Bibee? Maybe still Gavin Williams if he can get healthy? The other Logan Allen? Hunter Gaddis? Xavion Curry? Anybody?
Carlos Carrasco? No, it's not.
They might still be at the beginning of the year.
They still project him to be in the five starter.
I know. I think, leaving Bieber off that list, you would love for it to be Tristan McKenzie, because that he just needs to stay healthy. That kid has shown dominance when he's been healthy without overpowering stuff. He's just a really good pitcher. Like, he really commands the game. So you'd love to see it be Tristan McKenzie, but I don't know. I feel like this year it's going to be between Gavin Williams and Tanner Bibee. Those guys, they're the up and comers, and Tanner Bibee's got filthy stuff. If that guy stays healthy, he might become the star of this rotation.
Injury and all, and I'm not taking anything away from Tanner Bibee. And like Phil is saying, like, McKenzie just has to stay healthy. You need like 25 to 30 starts out of that guy. You have to prove that. But I think it's Gavin Williams just because of the history of this franchise. Because we saw like that historical handoff from Kluber to Bieber. And it seems like Gavin Williams fits that same mold that those two guys do. And that's what it takes to pitch dominantly in Cleveland. They're all kind of cut from the same cloth. So if he's healthy, I think that's the guy who you see as your frontline starter at some point this year.
I think I've been saying for 3 years that Tristan McKenzie has like Cy Young stuff. And it's just something always seems to get in the way. And I really want him to have that kind of season. I would love to see him dominate for the entire year, but I think I'm still with you guys. I think it's Bibee or Williams. I think I lead a little bit more towards Bibee because he was so much more impressive last year than anybody saw coming. And so I think he might be the guy that breaks out again and, can win you 17 or 18 games and low ERA and plenty of strikeouts and all that. So still plenty to be excited about with this starting rotation. I just need him to be healthy. Wrap these guys in bubble wrap and send them back to Cleveland now. Get ready for the season. Well, actually, send them to Oakland. Don't send them to Cleveland. It's going to be a mess. Send them to Oakland. That's where the season starts. Whoever's listening to this in the mailroom, that's where you got to send them. All right, fellas. With that, we are going to close out that segment, take our first break, come back, hit the road, and do nothing but talk football. Welcome back, fellas. Let's head out on the road. And let's face it, the 2024 NFL season has started. It's time for From the Land spring football. There's always time, my friends, for 24 Shades of Brown, our 24-week preview of the Browns 2024 season. We talked last week about the trade for Jerry Jeudy, and the Browns stayed busy all week long. Browns chose free agent Jameis Winston over Joe Flacco, and today brought in Tyler Huntley to add to the quarterback room with Deshaun Watson and DTR. What the heck is going on with all these quarterbacks?
Maybe they were just looking at last season and like, hey, we needed 4 different quarterbacks to start games for us. I don't know. I'm not as upset as social media was that Flacco didn't, I love Browns fans because I am one, but it's like we're all arguing 25 weeks out of who the backup should be. I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on. I guess you can't have too many. I think the Browns organization proved that last season, and everyone who's here has pretty good experience, I guess, and all kind of fit the same mold as the starting quarterback. So maybe it's a little more a continuity issue for who's playing behind center.
They needed 4 quarterbacks last year. And if you look at this current quarterback room, the 4 quarterbacks are better than what they trotted out there last year. And they're probably going to try to hide, I would imagine, try to hide one of these guys on the practice squad, be it a DTR or Huntley. I don't know. We caught lightning in a bottle with Joe Flacco last year. He wasn't even on a roster and he was awesome. And he stole our hearts, right? Because of what he did.
Yeah.
But a Jameis Winston is a true back. He's been in the NFL. He's played football games in the NFL. He's a better backup, I think. And I think, to your point, Gerbs, I think the skill set of all four of these guys lines up so that the offense just runs. It's just the same offense, no matter what. It's the same offense. Yeah. We're not going to switch things because there's a Joe Flacco back there. So I think if you look at it in totality, our four quarterbacks that we needed last year, this is an upgrade.
It's a lot of quarterbacks, but I guess it makes sense with what happened last year. I wasn't upset about choosing Winston over Flacco. There's a very real possibility that the real Joe Flacco was the one we saw in the playoff game and not the one we saw in the four games or five games before that. I don't know. That one didn't really bother me. The strangest thing I think of all of it is we've seen Tyler Huntley play some really good football. He's played some really good football against the Browns. And they said that they were signing him today. And I was like, gosh, I think he's better than Jameis Winston. This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. Like, I think maybe he should be the backup. Winston should be the third, and DTR can be on the practice squad. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they actually keep these guys all season. But, you know, certainly they showed last year, man, if they hadn't had the right guys in there last year, that season would have been lost with quarterback injuries. Now, the Browns did let linebackers Sione Takitaki and Anthony Walker leave for the Patriots and the Dolphins, respectively. Do you think JOK is good enough to play all the linebacker positions? More importantly, what do you think of this move and letting these guys go?
Well, they signed, what's his name from the Vikings, right? Like, what's his last name? Hicks? I can't remember. That's off the Jordan top Hicks. Of my head.
Signed, ooh. They ooh. Signed wow. Hicks.
Pulled
they
that
signed Devin Bush.
Devin Bush.
So, yeah. So, I get it. JOK is really not going to play all three positions.
But I'll answer your question. I think JOK is good enough, yes, to play all three positions in today's game at the linebacker position. But you know, you hate to see those guys go because they were building something. But at the same time, I think they may have already replaced them with the exact same level of talent, if maybe not even an upgrade with Hicks. Because the thing with Walker, if he's playing the same position, Walker just was never – healthy. He just couldn't stay on the field. So maybe we'll get a little bit more productivity out of a guy like Hicks.
I know people are upset about Takitaki more, even though I thought Walker was the better player, maybe because Taki was more homegrown. You saw him actually contribute and make leaps and bounds as a player. But I mean, Hicks is a guy who comes not only from the Vikings, but comes with Jim Schwartz from the Eagles. He played with Schwartz there. Devin Bush is a former first round pick for the Steelers who probably hasn't reached his potential. Maybe he never does. I don't know if he's, but I think Phil's right. Like, it's kind of apples to apples here. I don't know if any of them are any better or any worse than the guys who were here last year.
I'm okay with these moves. Takitaki is a nice player. It was great to see him kind of grow up in the organization. He's got a really cool last name. It's fun to say when, like, he makes plays and stuff like that. But that guy's not like a difference maker on your defense. And I think Anthony Walker was. But the problem is he got hurt so much. I didn't get a chance to look at it today, and I wanted to see how many games he's played like each of the last like 3 years. But I know for sure he's been hurt every single year he's played for the Browns. I think it's okay to let these guys go and to bring in some new people. Browns also added running back Nyheim Hines. Hines didn't play last year because of a knee injury. He had 66 yards on 48 carries in all of 2022. Is this the replacement for Kareem Hunt?
I really hope not. that's not a good average. Quick math, that's just barely over a yard per carry, right?
No. Is it? Yeah, I guess it is. Anyway.
I think they brought him in to catch balls out of the backfield, which is something Kareem Hunt did really well. I think he's injury prone as well. Like some of the other guys on this roster. However, I did see some tweet X thing that said at one point, like his PFF grade catching balls out of the backfield is pretty stellar. I guess. I don't know. We'll find out in 24 weeks, I guess.
He's a name. Like, I think everybody knows this guy because he had some productive years, but you know, this doesn't seem like a guy who's going to replace Kareem Hunt. Although I don't think the Browns are going to re-sign Kareem Hunt again this year. I just don't think that's going to happen. I think they're pretty much done with him, but I don't think Hines is the answer, and running back will continue to be an issue for this team as we wait to find out what guys are going to be in there and like who Nick Chubb is when he comes back next year. Let's move on from the Browns and take a look at a busy week for the AFC North as well. Scale of 1 to 5. 1 being fuck the Ravens. 5 being fuck the Ravens. What do you think of the Ravens signing Derrick Henry?
I'm at a 4.5. It's more of a, fuck. I don't care about his advanced age. He's not that old. Yes, there's a lot of miles on him. However, he's still a really productive player for a knock on the franchise who does not run the ball in the playoffs. You now have a guy who's really good at running the ball. It's just another piece for that franchise that needed it. I know they're more of a running back by committee type franchise for the past couple of years, mostly because of injuries. And he's not like he's been super successful against the Browns, but still, I don't want to see that guy in a fucking Ravens uniform. So fuck, you know, it's a 4.5.
I agree with Chuck. This is up the scale. This is a fuck the Ravens for sure. So 4.5, even 5. The guy is still top 5 running back in the NFL. And I agree with Chuck's take too. Like the Browns have not really had a problem with him historically, so that's great. But you put him in the backfield with Lamar Jackson, and I feel like maybe the two best runners in the AFC North are in that backfield together. Fuck the Ravens.
This is a 5 for me. As soon as I saw it like come across like the ticker, I thought, oh, this is bad. We're 24 weeks away from the season starting, so you really can't call somebody a favorite. But doesn't this make the Ravens a favorite in the AFC North? Because they now have a stud in that backfield. And I thought the same thing. I thought, gosh, is he starting to slow down? Is he starting to get old? I looked at his numbers. He's rushed for more than 1,000 yards like every year of his career except for one. Like, he's just fine. And that sub 1,000-yard season was not last year. He rushed for 1,000 last year. There's another situation, too, where he's been playing a lot of games with turds at quarterback, and he's not going to have that in Baltimore. He's going to be playing back there with an MVP. This sucks every way it possibly can. Fuck. Ravens. Moving on to Cincinnati. Bengals' biggest move so far was adding defensive tackle Sheldon Rankins from the Texans, but the Bengals lost Joe Mixon as well. We talked about it a few weeks ago. The Bengals had a ton of cap space. Did they get better so far this offseason?
No, unless that defensive lineman can turn around and play offensive line and block for Joe Burrow. They have now, there's time. They have yet to get better. I think they're the only team in the AFC North that hasn't gotten better yet.
I mean, they tagged, what's the receiver?
T. Higgins. But he wants,
Right, so he wants to be traded. So, no. The only thing that always worries about the Bengals, if they're healthy, no matter who is blocking or not, they're the only team that consistently plays the Chiefs really well. And that's, you know, Gerb, your pick to continue to win the Super Bowl. So I don't know how much better.
Every year until they don't.
Right. But when the division is getting better, every team in this division gets better and you have all that cap room and you do what we thought they would, not a whole lot of anything because they're a notoriously cheap franchise. And that's kind of where it's at. It's not the move they need to make. And maybe there's more coming up, or maybe they're picking the bottom of the barrel of who's left in free agency. But
I think with all that money, you'd expect a team, if it wasn't the Bengals and they didn't have that history of kind of being tight-fisted, you'd expect them to make a splash in those first few days of free agency because they have the cash to do it. And you're right. Like, the big names get signed in the first 3 or 4 days. After that, you're starting to deal with just a second tier of talent that maybe you're overpaying for, but also is probably not going to improve your team a ton. I was really surprised. I guess ultimately they didn't try to get more done. Losing Mixon, I think, is a big deal. That's a really productive back, man. That's a good football player that they let go. Well, I guess we'll see, man. Still plenty of time, still plenty of moves to make, but so far, not really shaking things up in the AFC North. The Steelers were the big winners in the mediocre quarterback market, landing 2 mediocre quarterbacks and getting rid of another all in 1 week. Steelers trade for Justin Fields, and they only had to give up a 6th-round pick. They traded Kenny Pickett to the Eagles and got a 3rd, a 4th, and 2 7th-round picks in return. The Steelers also signed Russell Wilson and already have named him as the starter for next season. Is there anything not to love about all of these moves?
Yeah. The fact that they're paying two starting NFL quarterbacks like $2 million, I don't love that. There's okay, a lot of, I mean, that's about it. From a logistics standpoint, looking at it, you brought in a guy who can play 1 year, but you're not going to get a look at the other guy who could be your bridge quarterback. Like, I think Justin Fields is a better quarterback than most people give him credit for. It's not like until this season when they shipped him out, it's not like the Bears have done anything to make their offense better until they got rid of Justin Fields. I think they're both smart, savvy moves. I don't know if either of them pay off, but for what we all love Kenny Pickett. Well, we love to watch Kenny Pickett play.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like for them, they got better, but I just think the fact that economically that's ridiculous. Even your punter makes more than $2 billion. And you got two NFL caliber quarterbacks who are making that for them.
I think the Browns are in for $67 million more for one quarterback in this coming season than their quarterback room. That's fine as long as we win football games. But is there anything not to love about this? The only thing I guess that you mentioned, Gerbs, is the picks they got for Kenny Pickett. How did they get that kind of pick haul for Kenny Pickett and only give up a sixth rounder for Fields? That's some crazy math right there. I don't know how that all worked out. So in typical Steelers fashion, I'm sure they'll turn some of those picks into guys that we hate in Cleveland for years to come, playing linebacker or defensive end or some shit.
Yep.
But in the meantime, I feel like their quarterbacks maybe are slightly better than last year, but maybe not.
When I first saw the Justin Fields news, I was bothered by it because I'm with you, Chucky. I think that guy can play. He just didn't have the organization or the talent around him in Chicago to do it. He might have it in Pittsburgh, certainly as the organization in Pittsburgh. But then first thing this morning, I read that Russell Wilson was still going to be the starter. I'm like, all right, well, I guess this isn't that bad.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of the guy who can't beat out Russell Wilson to start a quarterback in the NFL right now. So I guess that's fine. And I'm with Phil. I don't understand how Kenny Pickett garners four picks and Justin Fields only gets one. I don't care how bad Justin Fields has been. He's always been better than Kenny Pickett. My last thought on this was that there was a moment today where I thought, gosh, are the Steelers turning into the old Browns? Because this looks like some very old Browns type decision making here. We'll see. We're probably not that lucky, but I'm feeling pretty lucky so far with what we're looking at. Another one of the big moves was Kirk Cousins signing a new deal. By the way, did you know that it's Kirk, K-I-R-K, and not Kurt, C-U-R-T? I just learned that today. This guy's been in the league for like 15 years. I'm like, are you kidding me? I've been calling him Kirk Cousins the entire time. Anyway, he signs a 4-year, $180 million deal with Atlanta. He is 36. He is coming off of, I think it was an Achilles injury. And this is really a 2-year, $60 million deal because there's no guaranteed money after the second year. He now has signed deals totaling $281 million in career earnings, and this contract will push him past Tom Brady for the most career earnings by a quarterback. Is this a smart move for the Falcons?
I don't know. I thought they would go the Fields route because of all their young talent on offense, and you're kind of trying to hit the higher ceiling with less money. But I guess this could turn out to be a smart move in that division because you immediately have a legitimate quarterback if he's healthy, and they can win that division. They can immediately win that division with Robinson at running back and their tight end, and they've got some studs in skilled positions. How do we win right now in the NFL, right? And in that division, how do you win 10 games to win it? And maybe this is the smarter move then.
I wish I had his agent in my life that – makes him that much, not only makes him that much money, but you're coming off a massive injury as a aged quarterback.
Yeah.
But he's still the best one available in free agency, and he still makes your team better in a very winnable division. So even if it is for 2 years, they could win two division titles with Kurt Cousins.
Captain Kurt.
Captain. And you know, like, I think it's a pretty, like, $30 million is not bad for a guy of his caliber, you know, a guy who delivers. I don't know if he ever wins big games or big playoff games for them, but he's going to win a division for him, and he's going to make those young players much better. So I think it's a pretty smart move, and it's a smarter move for him to continue to stack that. That's unbelievable that he just keeps stacking that kind of money.
The Captain Kirk jokes make a lot more sense now than they have in the previous 14 years. I just thought they were calling him Captain Kurt. It still sounded good. It was like close. I don't know. I guess because of that division, it's a good idea. I don't know what kind of guy you're still getting from him at this age coming off of that injury, but that division has been one of the worst in football for a while now. And I think he can help, and he can certainly get them over that hump. Yeesh. That's a lot of money. All right, hey, real quick before we go, NCAA tournament selection was tonight, and the games start this week. That means it's Cat Tank Challenge time, our annual bracket pool with all of our buddies to determine who will win and who will lose and wear the Cat Tank on next year's trip. I know the brackets just came out, so I certainly don't expect you guys to have picks made, but can you already see the biggest mistake you're going to make in front of you right now?
Yes. I'm going to pick the Flyers to win two games.
Yeah.
Because my heart will take over. And in the second round, I think they line up against a two seed. So I'm not even confident they're going to win the first game. But that's my biggest mistake for sure.
Yes. It's twofold. One, I'm already locked out of my account because I don't know my password. So
that was mistake. Mail me a handwritten version of your bracket.
Yes. That's mistake one. A mistake too is, yeah, like I watched a little bit of championship week here, and I might have fallen in love with a team. I'm not going to give them away here. That I'm like, oh man, these guys will probably go far, knowing they will be upset in the first round, but I'll probably pick them to go to the Elite Eight.
Those bastards made Carolina a one seed.
Crazy.
Even though they lost in the semifinals of the ACC tournament, and I'm a sucker. If Carolina's a one seed, I'm absolutely picking them to win the entire thing. And it's probably a really bad year to do it. They've only got like one good player. Ugh. All right. Why don't we close things up there, fellas? We are going to take our final break, come back off the field, and have some fun talking Tombstone. Welcome back, fellas, to our final segment. We'll head off the field. And how about running in the cinema classics? Our first ever review of a classic movie. Tonight we are talking Tombstone, the Western classic released in December 1993. Tombstone grossed $73 million worldwide and is the 16th highest grossing Western of all time. I could not find any awards that Tombstone was nominated for, but Val Kilmer was nominated twice in the 1994 MTV Movie Awards for his role in the movie. He got nominated for Best Male Performance and Most Desirable Male, which is kind of funny considering he was a lunger throughout Tombstone. He lost Best Male Performance to Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. He lost Most Desirable Male to William Baldwin from the movie Sliver.
Oh, get out of here.
Not a good year.
So it may not have received a lot of critical support, but I'm 100% sure it received a lot of support from guys around our age. This is one of the few times where I can remember the first time I ever saw it in the movie theater. Very, very distinctly remember that. I thought you guys were there. We talked about it a little bit before we started tonight. Maybe I'm making that up. It's a pretty clear memory for me. I think I still may be right. Anyway, we watched Tombstone this week. Does the movie hold up?
Absolutely. It's a Western. All Westerns hold up, right? Like, it doesn't matter when you that's watch these true. Things. Well, that's true.
Quicken the Dead.
Quicken the Dead.
That's a very good point. Strike that from the record. So yes, this movie holds up because it's a really good movie. And if you want to watch a Western, I'm surprised to hear this is the 16th highest grossing Western of all time. I'd be hard pressed to find four Westerns better than this. And I mean, again, I'm biased. It's all about timing, right? We saw this thing in 93, early 94 as 16 to 17 year old buddies and have watched it hundreds of times since. So we are clearly biased. But I felt like it held up really well. I enjoyed it every time I watched it over the last couple of days.
I think it holds up forever and ever, and not just because we love it. I love Westerns, probably because of Tombstone, to be honest. But there's something a little different about this one. The dialogue holds up, the style holds up of it. It's a little different than most, because some of them, if you watch older Westerns, they're a little campy, and at times there might be a few campy lines in Tombstone. But it's just so well done. And I think a lot of it too is what feels it came along at the right time in our lives where There's some of the coolest characters ever on film to me are in this movie. The way they're written, the way they deliver line, even the style, what they wear for Westerns. So yeah, I think this movie will hold up 20 years from now or 30 years from now for a generation that even us, we're not talking about it anymore.
What I decided was that I just can't be objective. I love this movie so much. It's a, like you said, it's one of those things comes out at a great age for us. We're going to be totally into this. I was just as excited to watch it today as I am any time that I find it on TV. Like, I was giddy. But then, my gosh, there's a lot of melodrama in this, right? Is there a need at all for the entire storyline of his relationship with the actress? Is that really necessary?
Absolutely.
Disagree. Whole movie could have happened without that being in there. At times, it looked like small. Like, almost looked more like it was a TV show visually than a movie. But the great scenes are still great scenes. The scenes in the bar are fantastic. The duel with Ringo and Doc Holliday is amazing. You know, the river scene is fantastic. It's all so good. I just don't think I'm objective anymore. I think I love it too much to be able to decide whether it's still a good movie in 2024 like it was in 1993. All right, I have a series of random questions, none of which I thought were good enough on their own, but they were still kind of interesting to me. So I'm going to read off these four questions. You just pick the one that you want to answer and go ahead and answer it. Who was right about getting involved to solve crime in Tombstone? Virgil, who wanted to get involved, or Wyatt, who didn't? Isn't it weird that they go to the shootout at the OK Corral and Virgil just has a cane to fight with? Is Doc Holliday's girlfriend trying to kill him, like actively in the movie? Last one, is Wyatt the rider on the pale horse the Mexican preacher was talking about in the very first scene in the movie?
All good. Debatable, that last question. I think it's debatable if he is, even though he utters those lines later in the film.
Yeah.
I still think it's debatable. I'll go with the first one. Who was right, Virgil or Wyatt? Wyatt was right. The reason they went there was to finally be together and just fleece that town for as much money as humanly possible without getting involved. And then they get involved. Not by Wyatt's doing. He just decided to because his brothers got into it. But
Oh, that's debatable. What about when he goes out? He's the one who goes out and grabs Curly Bill by the ear. Isn't that the first moment they really get stuck into the mess?
Maybe. Maybe. But I still think that they set up the entire most of the movie with him saying, I'm not, they go out of their way for him to continue to say it three times. Like when they're at the show and he's being introduced, he doesn't even turn around. He's like, I'm not interested. Like he doesn't even let people finish their sentences. So I think Wyatt was always right. He knew what the town was about. He knew how to pimp the town and make as much money as humanly possible. But it all ends up that they were going to get involved because there has to be some law. Is that a Jason Priestley line from that movie?
It was. Yes.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know me, I want to answer all four of these questions. hard to pick one, man. I Chuck's right about Wyatt being right. So I can leave that one alone. I agree with Chuck on that. The other ones, you know what? I think the reason that Virgil goes into the fight at the OK Corral with a cane is because their better chance of winning that fight was given Doc Holliday the shotgun that Virgil originally had. Like, all right, you take the cane because Doc shooting anything is better than you with any weapon we might have. So that's why he made that decision. Man, I really want to answer all four of these questions. We'll do that for an outtake.
I'm going with the Virgil and the cane thing too, because I get that like, hey, we got to give Doc a good weapon to use. It's the Old West. They've got to be like shotguns just laying around everywhere. Like, what happened to the one they took from Billy Bob Thornton? Well, I get it. Like, what was the rush to be like, yeah. What's the rush with like, okay, we're going to give Doc the shotgun or the rifle. And like, Virgil just can't like walk back into the police station and pull like another one off the wall and use that. Like, why is he going into this fight with a cane? God, that was dumb. All right. Let's talk strategy a little bit. After Curly Bill gets killed, the fight is still going on between Wyatt and his guys and the Cowboys. At that time, the Cowboys outnumbered Wyatt and his guys 30-6 by my count, and one of Wyatt's guys was a Lunger. So, scale of 1 to 5. 1 being Kevin Stefanski goal line play calling two seasons ago. 5 being Kevin Stefanski goal line play calling last season. How bad a move was it by Ringo to try to settle this with single combat rather than just using his numerical advantage?
It's the worst move ever. It is Stefanski two seasons ago. It's like taking an army into Russia in the winter, right? Like everyone, it's just not going to work. It's not going to work. You had the advantage and you squandered it because of your ego, Ringo.
Well, we might actually have time to get back to that, Phil. I'm glad you brought that up.
It's a one, but I understand why Ringo did it. Like,
to be the man, you got to beat the man.
Yes. Right. Like, you know, like there was still, even though they were lawless cowboys, there was still some code in, especially in that time where most, when they said fight, I'll fight you right now, it doesn't mean fists. It meant like somebody's going to die because we're going to draw guns here. That's just kind of how it went. And I think that he was kind of just going with what happened strategically during the time. Like, if I kill this guy, this ends. And it was the same for why it agreed to it. If he dies, then it's over. So it's still a one. Strategically, it's stupid because you have the numbers. At all times, they have the numbers. Throughout the entire film, they have the numbers. At one point, there were 100 of them. But still, I understand why that Johnny Ringo decided that it should be a duel.
How do you think you would do in a duel?
I'd probably shoot myself in the kneecap or foot while I'm trying to pull it out very quickly and coolly like Doc Holliday does.
I thought the exact same thing. I'd probably fire my weapon before it's out of its holster and I'd be without a foot and then I'd have a head wound shortly thereafter.
I'm 100% sure like I'd drop the gun or something like that as I was pulling it. I would never even get a shot off. I don't think I'd be very good in a duel. Separating out the really obvious ones, like I'm your Huckleberry, best line in the movie. You going to do something or just stand there and bleed? Wyatt to the Pharaoh dealer. Next one. Evidently, Mr. Ringo is an educated man. Now I really hate him. That's Doc in the bar. I don't think I'll let you arrest us today, Behan. That's Wyatt after the OK Corral shootout. Why, Johnny Ringo? You look like someone just walked all over your grave. Doc right before the duel starts. Or say when from Doc during the final duel. Which of those, or if there's another one, let me know. This is really hard to pick.
Yeah, I can't. Every one you just rattled off there, I have on my short list, which isn't a very short list because there are some really great lines in this movie. Man, if I had a even throw Doc like, oh, Johnny, I apologize. I forgot you were there. You may leave now. Like, that's hilarious.
That's
like,
a that's, great one. Like, that Doc poor guy Holliday, gets humiliated so well in that scene.
The writing for Doc Holliday's character, for all the characters in this movie, but Doc's character specifically was so good. So you can't go wrong there. If I had to choose one from your list, I think it's why Johnny Ringo looks like someone just walked over your grave, because the gravitas of that scene and the line, the way it's delivered, you're like, oh shit, this is awesome. This is a great way to end this movie.
So I'll stay with the parameter here. It's so hard. I'm going to go with, are you going to stand there and just bleed? Only because 2 seconds before, he's like shitting and grinning, so happy to be in Tombstone. And you see that he has no fear. It's foreshadowing the rest of his character. There's just no fear. This guy is the toughest, apparently, guy in this place at that point. And he walks up to him and bitch slaps him a bunch of times. Yeah. And as if he's just going to bleed. It's the most badass line that Wyatt Earp delivers in the entire film, in my opinion, without having a weapon. So I think in the context of the four you gave us, that's probably the coolest one.
I'm with you on Doc. Like, that was the one thing I think I picked up from watching it today, was his character, both the writing and his acting, really is like a head and shoulders above everybody else in the movie. Everybody else is fine. Everybody else does a good job. There really is like something special about what he did, but it's evidently Mr. Ringo is an educated man. Now I really hate him. Oh man, that was good. That was a good line. Let's talk remaking Tombstone. 2021. There was a TV movie named Once Upon a Time in Tombstone that was a remake of the movie. It got a 1.8 rating on Rotten Tomatoes and was described as the worst thing ever seen.
Right.
There are rumors about a 2024 or 2025 remake with Matthew McConaughey as Wyatt Earp. Is the original Tombstone too good to remake?
I cannot be objective with this answer, much like you couldn't before, yeah. Curves. Like I feel like this is one of those movies you just leave alone because you can watch it in 2024 and it's just as good. But Hollywood's going to remake shit because there's more money to be made. They'll make three times as much money with Matthew McConaughey. But should it be remade? No, no, leave this alone. It's just perfect the way it is.
I go see it day one.
I'm going to see it. Like, yeah, yeah. Like, hell yeah, like, I'm going.
I go see it day one. It doesn't mean I love it more. Do I want to see any differences in it? No. If you say, I think McConaughey's a great choice to play Wyatt Earp, who's playing Doc Holliday is the more important choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, is there somebody who's going to be that cool? And I don't know. I was trying to think very quickly while you're saying, like, if they're going to reboot this. That's the first thing I went, like, who's going to play Doc Holliday? I would go, I'd probably enjoy it for what it was. Will it touch one of my favorite movies of all time? Probably not. But I'd still be there probably opening night. They probably wouldn't do, if they did a midnight screening, I'd be asleep by 12:07. So I would wait till like a Tuesday night or a Wednesday.
I don't know. Sometimes there should just be movies that don't get remade. They're just too good. They're too unique. They fit too perfectly into the moment when they came out. I suppose you're right. I would watch it because it's such a fantastic story, but I don't think you should be remaking this movie. It was too good, too unique. The character's too good. It shouldn't be redone. You're never going to top Doc Holliday played by Val Kilmer. You're never going to, man. I don't care who does it. I'm on the side of not redoing this, but I am also on the side of I would absolutely watch it if it came out. Let's talk gunslingers a little bit. Pretty obvious in this movie and through history that gunslingers like Doc and Ringo are really, really arrogant. What athlete, past or present, do you think would have been a good gunslinger?
Oh boy. I'm going to go with the GOAT. Michael Jordan would be a really good gunslinger.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Deion Sanders.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Would be a really good, because he was a lot more bravado than Jordan,
yeah,
but backed it up every second of every play that he was on the field. So I think Deion Sanders would be a great gunslinger.
I'm glad we got to this. I'm going with Allen Iverson. Was the first one. The arrogance.
They're all basketball players.
I know. What are we doing here? What are we doing here?
Well, Deion.
Evan Mobley. Football,
right?
Evan
oh, that's Mobley. True.
Yeah. Evan
oh,
shit. Mobley. Sorry. Not a good gunslinger.
Sedrunas Ogavskis. All right. This movie had like a lot of characters in it. So, best cameo in the movie. Jason Priestley, we already mentioned him. Lowell from Wings was in this. Rowdy from Days of Thunder. The mayor of Tombstone is John Locke from Lost.
Yeah.
Frank Stallone was Ed Bailey in the first Doc Holliday scene.
Yeah.
And near the end, you get Charlton fucking Heston. So what was your favorite cameo in the movie?
Maybe Stallone. He's really great in it, where Charlton Heston's kind of like just a cardboard cutout of himself. Yeah,
there's not
movie.
A lot left in the tank.
There's not much there. But Stallone, it's a pivotal point because that's the first time you're seeing Doc Holliday. Again, it's mostly Val Kilmer delivering great lines to him. But I like Stallone. I was like, even when I watched it last night, I've seen this movie hundreds of times. I'm like, God damn it, is that Frank Stallone in this movie? Yeah. Is Frank Stallone in this movie? So I'm going with him.
I agree with Chuck with the Charlton Heston thing. Like, I feel like that was probably at the time the cameo that was going to garner like, oh, look at this. Oh, this is a big get. Because I think like Lowell was pre-Wings maybe, or like right when Wings was starting, 93?
No, that was after Wings. He was already famous for Wings. Yeah,
really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Regardless, I like, what's his name? Michael Rooker. Because he was in Days of Thunder. And I don't know what year that came out, but it was around that time, right? Like probably.
Yeah, this might have been Rooker's heyday.
Yeah. So McMasters was more than just a bit character though. He was in the whole movie until the very end. Spoiler alert, he gets dragged. I don't want to give that away for those listeners who haven't seen Tombstone yet.
35-year-old spoiler.
Yeah. I like Michael Rooker was, they were all good though, man. Like they were, there were so many in this movie. They were, it was really good, but I like his role. He had a, he was the first one that kind of realized the Cowboys were like, fuck this, I'm out. I'm on, yeah. I'm on Wyatt's side. So I liked his role in that movie.
I'm going with Frank Stallone too. I actually had to look it up. I was looked up like who's in, you know, this movie that I don't remember was in it. And the very first one is Frank Stallone. I'm like, fuck you. Who is Frank Stallone in this movie? And there you go. He's Ed Bailey. Why, Ed, are we cross? Is Tombstone the last great Western that's been made? Something to consider. Open Range came out in 2002. True Grit in 2010. Don't shake your head at Open Range. Mm-hmm. Django was 2012. And Hateful Eight was 2015.
Damn it. You have two Tarantino movies on that list.
Yeah.
But the Tarantino ones are, oh, Django's not real. I can't match dialogue with Quentin Tarantino movies, man. Like that's almost insane. I'm too biased here. Yeah. To me, it's the last great Western that came out. Even though The Hateful Eight's a really good movie and Django's better, in my opinion, than Hateful Eight. Open Range is okay, I guess. You know, Open Range is all right. I'm too biased. I'm finally saying the words you two said. I'm too biased. Yes, it's the best Western that has came out since it came out.
I like all those movies that you offered up, but Chuck's right. This is the best one since 93. I had to look it up real quick while Chuck was answering, and I thought about The Unforgiven, but that came out the year before.
The year before.
Yeah. So that's disqualified. I don't know that I would still put it ahead of Tombstone, but a really good Western, right? So I think since Tombstone came out in late 93, it is the best Western we've seen.
I agree with you guys, mostly because I can't look at Django and Hateful Eight as Westerns. Those are Tarantino movies. It's like a different animal. You know, it's Tombstone has so many classic aspects of Westerns. And I love Westerns too. Before Tombstone, I loved Westerns. I wanted to steal a horse and like ride out west when I was like a little kid. I've always loved these stories. Tombstone feels like a modern version of a classic Western, where those other ones are just, they're just different animals completely in my mind. So I do think Tombstone was the last great Western ever made. So I don't even know why I'm asking. You want to put bourbon or want to put Tombstone on the bourbon scale?
Sure. It's a Burke 7. I don't even. Yeah, that's it. That's it, man.
Yeah, it's a Burke 7. It is one of my favorite movies. I will never get sick of watching it. It was great to watch it from start to finish. Like Phil had said earlier, like not just catching it in progress, like beginning to end through the credits, man. Like I stayed the entire time and soaked it all in. It is a Burke 7. There will probably never be another Western that I love as much as this one.
Yeah, it's a 7 for me too. This is too good. I actually haven't seen it in a really long time. And I was really entertained and maybe it missed it at some point, but this movie is paced extremely well. Like every scene builds to like the next scene and moves you. Like it's just a really well put together movie. Super entertaining, great characters, great lines. This has been the easiest bourbon scale we've ever done on this show, man. This is easily a Burke 7. But fellas, we are out of time. I am out of questions for now. And we just did the whole show without mentioning that the Yinzes suffered another sports tragedy this week when 18,000 Jahmir Yager bobbleheads were stolen.
That's great.
With that news about the worst thing that happened to the mullet since Billy Ray Cyrus got a haircut. I hope you guys have a great week. And let's get together and do this again real soon.
Absolutely. Oh, man.
I have a Tombstone question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think Tombstone's about? What do you think the central theme to Tombstone
That's
is?
That's the one question I didn't
get. Is it? Oh, well, go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead, Phil.
Wow. The central theme, I think it's introduced early on and then comes to fruition at the very end. It's about seeking that your life, right? Like what is happiness in life? It's about that pursuit of happiness. And within that path, you're constantly pulled back to what you're really good at. and what you're really good at might be being a lawman or being whatever it is. So you're constantly being pulled back into a life you're trying to escape from to find that happiness, which in this, a scene I don't think resonated with me early on in viewing this, but certainly did this weekend, is early in the movie when the six of them stare into their reflection in the window and Wyatt just says, nope, don't talk. Don't talk.
Yeah.
Just look. I'm like, all right, that's a bunch of people who want out. They've gotten to this point. They want to pursue this happiness. And then all this shit goes sideways.
Yeah.
And then at the end, Wyatt's he finds it, right? He's dancing in the snow. That's why that relationship's important, Gerber. That's why that's important. The dance in the snow, the room service. Good for Wyatt.
I get it.
That's my take.
I agree. It's absolutely about like that, like finding your happiness, finding your real joy, and like why it was so, so determined not to be a lawman. And so focused on just making money. It was the only thing he talked about. It was the only thing he did. And in the end, he's broke, which I would ask a follow-up question of why the fuck is he broke all of a sudden?
Right.
Yeah. He was doing just fine. Either. It's not like he lost any of his businesses, you know?
Charlton Heston must really pay.
But he finally gives
a lot of rent for that one night. Like, holy right. shit.
Yeah.
Give me your copper mines. All of that... like he's away from all of it by the time he gets to the end and he finds like the right woman. I don't know if there was ever a movie wife who was from beginning to end worse than Wyatt's first wife, Mandy.
Maddie.
Except for Maddie,
yeah. Maddie Blaylock.
So I think that's what did you think it was about, Chuck?
Yeah, Chuck.
Because I thought you were going to ask it. I'm like, I never really watched it. And I think it's about, there's that one motherfucker in your life that has your back no matter what. And it doesn't have to be blood. There is that person that just gets you, is always there for you, will fight for you, will kill for you, will support you, will lift you up. And that's, I was like, this movie's about Doc and Wyatt's friendship throughout they talk about it throughout. Like even Virgil tries, I caught it for the first time in hundreds of times where he asks, is Doc here? And Virgil kind of says, well, I hope not.
Yeah,
like right. he says
yeah.
it under
oh,
his
yeah.
breath.
Right
like,
away.
What?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I never even heard that part. Yeah. So like that's what I thought it was about. Like, because there's always somebody to, no matter what, is going to tell you the truth. And when Doc's dying, he tells him, this is what you have. You go find her. You go find your love. You have that one dude who guides your life and he knows what's best for you, even if you don't. And I'm like, I thought that's what it's most about. Like that, their friendship, that they were more family than than his brothers were, to be honest.
Yeah.
And see, I would say my argument for eliminating the entire romantic storyline from this fucking thing is then it really would have been about him and Doc and like their friendship. And I agree with you. That's, and again, like we're awfully biased in this because, you know, like, you know, being friends is the best. It is, that's what it should have been about. But I get so caught up in this with this woman. She's fantastic. Like I had forgotten, like some of these scenes really came out funny watching them so many years later, where it's like, it's after the OK Corral has happened. And so she hates Behan now. And he comes in to see her and she's just like reading a book. And she's like, I'm busy.
I'm busy.
And she's like, turns her head to him. And she ain't busy. You're reading a book. Put your bookmark in. Shut the thing and listen to me. That was so funny. Also, I did not appreciate the fact that it, like it ends. Doc tells him like, hey, you got to go. And why it's like, all right, well, thanks for always being there. And just walks out, like no hug, no handshake, anything like that. Like he just like, I didn't like that part.
Did you cry at that part?
When Doc dies?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever cried.
When he's telling him, like, if you ever felt anything for me, like leave, just leave now.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
What do you think Doc thinks is so funny in his last line?
That's a great question. I think, like most gunslingers at that time, you're supposed to die with your boots on. Like, you're supposed to die.
Wow, that's good. Yeah.
And he looks down and sees, like, just his feet staring back at him. And he's, oh, this is funny. That's what I think. That's what I thought it was about.
That's really good.
After watching it hundreds of times, that's what I thought it was
about. Yeah. Phil?
Yeah, that's better than anything I could have come up with. I was along that, along those lines. I kind of thought similar to that was, here's a gunslinger who had to be living his whole life thinking he's going to die by catching a bullet to the forehead in some dusty town somewhere. And here he is in a bed with his feet sticking out from under the covers in Colorado, with priests and nuns all around. And that was funny to him.
Yeah. I've always thought that he must be starting to get like his first glimpses of heaven, 'cause he dies like right afterwards. But you guys are right. Yeah, that makes sense, because he's looking at his feet, obviously.
Maybe he's going to hell, like Wyatt said. Is there a sign for that?
Yeah.
They traded traded Deontay Johnson. To Tennessee, maybe. Tennessee got better. The Dolphins got better. The Bears got better. Miami got better.
The Texans,
man.
Yep.
Like, they see it, man. Jeez. They see the window. They're like, okay, we're here.
But they hit on a franchise quarterback. They hit on a quarterback that's on his rookie deal still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's do this now.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was the Odell Beckham move to Cleveland.
He got cut.
Yeah.
Tough break.
I saw what's his name? Jarvis Landry is actively petitioning every team in the NFL to please give him a contract. And of course, all the Browns fans on social media are like, play. Like, come back.
I want to see Flacco come throwing back to Jarvis Landry.
Yeah.
Yeah. On my flag football team.
I would hope Jarvis Landry would be our fourth or fifth best receiver at best at this point, right?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. All right. 12:03. You got
me. We did it.
Yes. We did it.
A couple more of these to do it.
That's right. There's only two left. Only two left. All right, boys. That was a ton of fucking fun. That was great. Think of some ideas for next week. And we'll figure something out.
All right, man.
All right.
All right, boys. All right. Love you guys.
Love you, boys.
Love you, fellas.
Good night.
Funny like clown, you're the music.